أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله هيا
الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين يوم يفر المرء من أخيه وأمه وأبيه وصاحبته وبنيه لكل امرئ منهم يومئذ شأن يغنيه وجوه يومئذ مسفرة ضاحكة مستبشرة ووجوه يومئذ عليها غبرة ترهقها قترة أولئك هم الكفرة الفجرة الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين القارعة ما القارعة وما أدراك ما القارعة يوم يكون الناس كالفراش المبثوث وتكون الجبال كالعهن المنفوش فأما من ثقلت موازينه فهو في عيشة راضية وأما من خفت موازينه فأمه هاوية وما أدراك ما هي نار حامية الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. استغفر الله استغفر, استغفر الله من السلام قسم الله يا ذا الجلال والإكرام برحمتك يا رب.
Thank you. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. أفمن يعلم أنما أنزل إليك من ربك الحق كمن هو أعمى، إنما يتذكر أولو الألباب، الذين يوفون بعهد الله ولا ينقضون الميثاق، والذين يصلون ما أمر الله به أن يوصل ويخشون ربهم ويخافون سوء الحساب، والذين صبروا ابتغاء وجه ربهم وأقاموا الصلاة وأنفقوا مما رزقناهم سرا وعلانية ويدرؤون بالحسنة السيئة أولئك لهم عقبى الدار، جنات عدن يدخلونها ومن صلح من آبائهم وأزواجهم وذرياتهم والملائكة يدخلون عليهم من كل باب، سلام عليكم بما صبرتم فنعم عقبى الدار، والذين ينقضون عهد الله من بعد ميثاقه ويقطعون ما أمر الله به أن يوصل ويفسدون في الأرض، أولئك لهم اللعنة ولهم سوء الدار. الله يبسط الرزق لمن يشاء ويقدر، فرحوا بالحياة الدنيا وما الحياة الدنيا في الآخرة إلا متاع، ويقول الذين كفروا لولا أنزل عليه آية من ربه، قل إن الله يضل من يشاء ويهدي إليه من أناب، الذين آمنوا وتطمئن قلوبهم بذكر الله، ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب، الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات توبى لهم حسن مآب. كذلك أرسلناك في أمة قد خلت من قبلها أمم لتتلو عليهم الذي أوحينا إليك وهم يكفرون بالرحمن، قل هو ربي لا إله إلا هو عليه توكلت وإليه متاب. ولو أن قرآنا سيرت به الجبال أو قطعت به الأرض أو كلم به الموتى، بل لله الأمر جميعا، أفلم ييأس الذين آمنوا أن لو يشاء الله لهدى الناس جميعا، ولا يزال الذين كفروا تصيبهم بما صنعوا قارعة أو تحل قريبا من دارهم حتى يعدي وعد الله، إن الله لا يخلف الميعاد. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ولقد استهزئ برسل من قبلك فأمليت للذين كفروا ثم أخذتهم، فكيف كان عقاب؟ أفمن هو قائم على كل نفس بما كسبت، وجعلوا لله شركاء قل سموهم، أم تنبئونه بما لا يعلم في الأرض أم بظاهر من القول، بل زين للذين كفروا مكرهم وصدوا عن السبيل، ومن يضلل الله فما له من هاد، لهم عذاب في الحياة الدنيا والعذاب الآخرة أشق، وما لهم من الله من واق. مثل الجنة التي وعد المتقون تجري من تحتها الأنهار، أكلها دائم وظلها، تلك عقبى الذين اتقوا، وعقبى الكافرين النار. والذين آتيناهم الكتاب يفرحون بما أنزل إليك وما أنزل إليك، ومن الأحزاب من ينكر بعده، قل إنما أمرت أن أعبد الله ولا أشرك به، إليه أدعو وإليه مآب. وكذلك أنزلناه حكما عربيا، ولئن اتبعت أهواءهم بعد ما جاك من العلم ما لك من الله من ولي ولا واق.
الله أكبر.
سمع سمع الله لمن حمده.
الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ولقد أرسلنا رسلا من قبلك وجعلنا لهم أزواجا وذرية. ولقد أرسلنا رسلا من قبلك وجعلنا لهم أزواجا وذرية، وما كان لرسول أن يأتي بآية إلا بإذن الله، لكل أجل كتاب، يمحو الله ما يشاء ويثبت، وعنده أم الكتاب. وإما نرينك بعد الذي نعدهم أو نتوفينك فإنما عليك البلاغ وعلينا الحساب. أولم يروا أنا نأتي الأرض ننقصها من أطرافها، والله يحكم لا معقب لحكمه، وهو سريع الحساب. وكان مكر الذين من قبلهم فلله المكر جميعا، يعلم ما تكسب كل نفس، وسيعلم الكفار من نقب الدار. ويقول الذين كفروا لست مرسلا، قل كفى بالله شهيدا بيني وبينكم ومن عنده علم الكتاب. ألف لام را، كتاب أنزلناه إليك لتخرج الناس من الظلمات إلى النور بإذن ربهم إلى صراط العزيز الحميد. الله الذي له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض، وويل للكافرين من عذاب شديد. الذين يستحبون الحياة الدنيا على الآخرة ويصدون عن سبيل الله ويبغونها عوجا، أولئك في ضلال بعيد. ولكن أرسلنا رسلا وما أرسلنا من رسول إلا بلسان قومه لنبين لهم، فيدل الله من يشاء ويهدي من يشاء، وهو العزيز الحكيم. ولقد أرسلنا موسى بآياتنا أن أخرج قومك من الظلمات إلى النور، وذكرهم بأيام الله، إن في ذلك لآيات لكل صبار شكور. وإذ قال موسى لقومه اذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ أنجاكم من آل فرعون يسومونكم سوء العذاب ويذبحون أبناءكم ويستحيون نساءكم، وفي ذلكم بلاء من ربكم عظيم.
الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. وإذ تأذن ربكم لئن شكرتم لأزيدنكم ولئن كفرتم إن عذابي لشديد. وقال موسى إن تكفروا أنتم ومن في الأرض جميعا فإن الله لغني حميد. ألم يأتكم نبأ الذين من قبلكم قوم نوح وعاد وثمود والذين من بعدهم لا يعلمهم إلا الله جاءتهم رسلهم من البينات فردوا أيديهم في أفواههم وقالوا إنا كفرنا بما أرسلتم به وإنا لفي شك مما تدعوننا إليه مريب. قالت رسلهم في الله شك فاتن السماوات والأرض يدعوكم ليغفر لكم من ذنوبكم ويوقظكم إلى أجل مسمى قالوا إن أنتم إلا بشر مثلنا تريدون أن تصدونا عما كان يعبد آباؤنا فأتونا بسلطان مبين. قال لهم رسلهم إن نحن إلا بشر مثلكم ولكن الله يمن على من يشاء من عباده وما كان لنا أن نأتيكم بسلطان إلا بإذن الله وعلى الله فليتوكل المؤمنون. وما لنا ألا نتوكل على الله وكان هدانا سبلنا ولنصبرن على ما آذيتمونا وعلى الله فليتوكل المتوكلون.
الله أكبر.
سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. وقال الذين كفروا لرسلهم لنخرجنكم من أرضنا أو لتعودن في ملتنا فأوحى إليهم ربهم لنهلكن الظالمين ولنسكننكم الأرض من بعدهم ذلك لمن خاف مقامي وخاف وعيد واستفتحوا وخاف كل جبار عنيد. من ورائه جهنم ويسقى من ماء صديد يتجرعه ولا يكاد يسيغه ويأتيه الموت من كل مكان وما هو بميت ومن ورائه عذاب غليظ. مثل الذين كفروا ربهم أعمالهم كرماد اشتدت به الريح في يوم عاصف لا يقدرون على شيء مما كسبوا والله لا يهدي القوم الكافرين. مثل الذين كفروا بربهم أعمالهم كرماد اشتدت به الريح في يوم عاصف لا يقدرون على شيء مما كسبوا إن الله لا يهدي القوم الكافرين. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ألم تر أن الله خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق إن يشأ يذهبكم ويأتي بخلق جديد وما ذلك على الله بعزيز. وبرزوا لله جميعا فقال الضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنها من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا لو هدانا الله لهديناكم سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص. وقال الشيطان لما قضي الأمر إن الله وعدكم وعد الحق ووعدتكم فأخلفتكم وما كان لي عليكم من سلطان إلا أن دعوتكم فاستجبتم لي فلا تلوموني ولوموا أنفسكم ما أنا بمصرخكم وما أنتم بمصرخي إني كفرت بما أشركتمون من قبل إن الظالمين لهم عذاب أليم. وأدخل الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات جنات تجري من تحتها الأنهار خالدين فيها بإذن ربهم تحيتهم فيها سلام. ألم تر كيف ضرب الله مثلا كلمة طيبة كشجرة طيبة نسلها ثابت وفرعها في السماء تؤتي أكلها كل حين بإذن ربها ويضرب الله الأمثال للناس لعلهم يتذكرون. ومثل كلمة خبيثة كشجرة خبيثة اجتثت من فوق الأرض ما لها من قرار يثبت الله الذين آمنوا بالقول الثابت في الحياة الدنيا وفي الآخرة ويضل الله الظالمين ويفعل الله ما يشاء. ألم تر إلى الذين بدلوا نعمة الله كفرا وأحلوا قومهم دار البوار جهنم يصلونها وبئس القرار وجعلوا لله أندادا ليضلوا عن سبيله قل تمتعوا فإن مصيركم من النار. قل لعبادي الذين آمنوا يقيموا الصلاة وينفقوا مما رزقناهم سرا وعلانية من قبل أن يأتي يوم لا بيع فيه ولا خلال. الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض وأنزل من السماء ماء فأخرج به من الثمرات رزقا لكم وسخر لكم الفلك لتجري في البحر بأمره وسخر لكم الأنهار وسخر لكم الشمس والقمر دائبين وسخر لكم الليل والنهار وآتاكم من كل ما سألتموه وإن تعدوا نعمة الله لا تحصوها إن الإنسان لظلوم كفار. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. مثل الذين كفروا بربهم أعمالهم كرماد اشتدت به الريح في يوم عاصف لا يقدرون على شيء مما كسبوا ذلك هو الضلال البعيد. وإذ قال إبراهيم رب اجعل هذا البلد آمنا واجنبني وبني أن نعبد الأصنام رب إنهن أضلل كثيرا من الناس فمن تبعني فإنه مني ومن عصاني فإنك غفور رحيم. ربنا إني أسكنت من ذريتي بواد غير ذي زرع عند بيتك المحرم ربنا ليقيموا الصلاة فاجعل أفئدة من الناس تهوي إليهم وارزقهم من الثمرات لعلهم يشكرون. ربنا إنك تعلم ما نخفي وما نعلن وما يخفى على الله من شيء في الأرض ولا في السماء. الحمد لله الذي وهبني على الكبر إسماعيل وإسحاق إن ربي لسميع الدعاء. رب اجعلني مقيم الصلاة ومن ذريتي ربنا وتقبل دعاء. ربنا اغفرني ولوالدي وللمؤمنين يوم يقوم الحساب. ولا تحسبن الله غافلا عما يعمل الظالمون إنما يؤخرهم ليوم تشخص فيه الأبصار. مهطعين رؤوسهم لا يرتد إليهم طرفهم وأفئدتهم هوى. وأنذر الناس يوم يأتيهم العذاب فيقول الذين ظلموا ربنا أخرنا إلى أجل قريب نجب دعوتك ونتبع الرسل ولم تكونوا أقسمتم من قبل ما لكم من زوال. وسكنتم في مساكن الذين ظلموا أنفسهم وتبين لكم كيف فعلنا بهم وضربنا لكم الأمثال. وقد مكروا مكرهم وعند الله مكرهم وإن كان مكرهم لتزول منه الجبال. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. فلا تحسبن الله مخلف وعده رسله إن الله عزيز ذو انتقام. يوم تبدل الأرض غير الأرض والسماوات وبرزوا لله الواحد القهار. وترى المجرمين يومئذ مقرنين في الأصفاد سرابيلهم من قطران وتغشى وجوههم النار. ليجزي الله كل نفس ما كسبت إن الله سريع الحساب. هذا بلاغ للناس ولينذروا به وليعلموا أنما هو إله واحد وليذكر ذكر أولو الألباب. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ألف لام را، تلك آيات الكتاب وقرآن مبين. ربما يود الذين كفروا لو كانوا مسلمين. ذرهم يأكلوا ويتمتعوا ويلههم الأمل فسوف يعلمون. وما أهلكنا من قرية إلا ولها كتاب معلوم. ما تسبق من أمة أجلها وما يستأخرون. وقالوا يا أيها الذي نزل عليه الذكر إنك لمجنون. لو ما تأتينا بالملائكة إن كنت من الصادقين. ما ننزل الملائكة إلا بالحق وما كانوا إذا منظرين. إنا نحن نزلنا الذكر وإنا له لحافظون. ولقد أرسلنا من قبلك في شيع الأولين. وما يأتيهم من رسول إلا كانوا به يستهزئون. كذلك نسلكه في قلوب المجرمين. لا يؤمنون به وقد خلت سنة الأولين. ولو فتحنا عليهم بابا من السماء فظلوا فيه عرجون. لقالوا إنما سكرت أبصارنا بل نحن قوم مسحورون. ولقد جعلنا في السماء بروجا وزيناها للناظرين. وحفظناها من كل شيطان رجيم. إلا من استرق السمع فأتبعه شهاب مبين. والأرض مددناها وألقينا فيها رواسي وأنبتنا فيها من كل شيء موزون. وجعلنا لكم فيها معايش ومن لستم له برازقين. وإن من شيء إلا عندنا خزائنه وما ننزله إلا بقدر معلوم. وأرسلنا الرياح لواقح فأنزلنا من السماء ماء فأسقيناكم وما أنتم له بخازنين. وإنا لنحن نحيي ونميت ونحن الوارثون. ولقد علمنا المستقدمين منكم ولقد علمنا المستأخرين. وإن ربك هو يحشرهم إنه حكيم عليم. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ولقد خلقنا الإنسان من صلصال من حمأ مسنون. والجان خلقناه من قبل من نار السموم. وإذ قال ربك للملائكة إني خالق بشرا من صلصال من حمأ مسنون. فإذا سويته ونفخت فيه من روحي فقعوا له ساجدين. فسجد الملائكة كلهم أجمعون. إلا إبليس أبى أن يكون مع الساجدين. قال يا إبليس ما لك ألا تكون مع الساجدين. قال لم أكن لأسجد لبشر خلقته من صلصال من حمأ مسنون. قال فاخرج منها فإنك رجيم. وإن عليك اللعنة إلى يوم الدين. قال رب فأنظرني إلى يوم يبعثون. قال فإنك من المنظرين إلى يوم الوقت المعلوم. قال رب بما أغويتني لأزينن لهم في الأرض ولأغوين إنهم أجمعين إلا عبادك منهم المخلصين. قال هذا صراط علي مستقيم. إن عبادي ليس لك عليهم سلطان إلا من اتبعك من الغاوين. وإن جهنم لموعدهم أجمعين لها سبعة أبواب لكل باب منهم جزء مقسوم.
الله أكبر.
سمع الله لمن حمده.
الله أكبر. الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. إن المتقين في جنات وعيون ادخلوها بسلام آمنين ونزعنا ما في صدورهم من غل إخوانا على سرر متقابلين لا يمسهم فيها نصب وما هم منها بمخرجين نبئ عبادي أني أنا الغفور الرحيم وأن عذابي هو العذاب الأليم ونبئهم عن ضيف إبراهيم إذ دخلوا عليه فقالوا سلاما قال إنا منكم جنون. قالوا لا توجل إنا نبشرك بغلام عليم قال أبشرتموني على أن مسني الكبر فبما تبشرون قالوا بشرناك بالحق فلا تكن من القانطين قال ومن يقنط من رحمة ربه إلا الضالون قال فما خطبكم أيها المرسلون قالوا إنا أرسلنا إلى قوم مجرمين إلا آل لوط إنا لمنجوهم أجمعين إلا امرأته قدرنا إنها لمن الغابرين فلما جاء آل لوط المرسلون قال إنكم قوم منكرون قالوا بل جئناك بما كانوا فيه يمترون وأتيناك بالحق وإنا لصادقون فأسر بأهلك بقطع من الليل واتبع أدبارهم ولا يلتفت منكم أحد وامضوا حيث تؤمرون وقضينا إليه ذلك الأمر أن دابر هؤلاء مقطوع مصبحين وجاء أهل المدينة يستبشرون قال إن هؤلاء ضيفي فلا تفضحون واتقوا الله ولا تخزون قالوا أولم ننهك عن العالمين قال هؤلاء بناتي إن كنتم فاعلين لعمرك إنهم لفي سكرتهم يعمهون فأخذتهم الصيحة مشرقين فجعلنا عاليها سافلها وأمطرنا عليهم حجارة من سجيل إن في ذلك لآيات للمتوسمين وإنها لبسبيل مقيم إن في ذلك لآية للمؤمنين وإن كان أصحاب الأيكة لظالمين فانتقمنا منهم وإنهما لبإمام مبين. الله أكبر.
سمع الله لمن حمده.
الله أكبر. الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين ولقد كذب أصحاب الحجر المرسلين وآتيناهم آياتنا فكانوا عنها معرضين وكانوا ينحتون من الجبال بيوتا آمنين فأخذتهم الصيحة مصبحين فما أغنى عنهم ما كانوا يكسبون وما خلقنا السماوات والأرض وما بينهما إلا بالحق وإن الساعة لآتية فاصفح الصفح الجميل إن ربك هو الخلاق العليم ولقد آتيناك سبعا من المثاني القرآن العظيم لا تمدن عينيك إلى ما متعنا به أزواجا منهم ولا تحزن عليهم واخفض جناحك للمؤمنين وقل إني أنا النذير المبين كما أنزلنا على المقتسمين الذين جعلوا القرآن عضين فوربك لنسألنهم أجمعين عما كانوا يعملون فاصدع بما تؤمر وأعرض عن المشركين إنا كفيناك المستهزئين الذين يجعلون مع الله إلها آخر فسوف يعلمون ولقد نعلم أنك يضيق صدرك بما يقولون فسبح بحمد ربك وكن من الساجدين واعبد ربك حتى يأتيك اليقين الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر السلام عليكم ورحمة الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين أتى أمر الله فلا تستعجلوه سبحانه وتعالى عما يشركون ينزل الملائكة بالروح من أمره على من يشاء من عباده أن أنذروا أنه لا إله إلا أنا فاتقون خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق تعالى عما يشركون خلق الإنسان من نطفة فإذا هو خصيم مبين والأنعام خلقها لكم فيها دفء ومنافع ومنها تأكلون ولكم فيها جمال حين تريحون وحين تسرحون وتحمل أثقالكم إلى بلد لم تكونوا بالغيه إلا بشق الأنفس إن ربكم لرؤوف رحيم والخيل والبغال والحمير لتركبوها وزينة ويخلق ما لا تعلمون وعلى الله قصد السبيل ومنها جائر ولو شاء لهداكم أجمعين هو الذي أنزل من السماء ماء لكم منه شراب ومن منه شجر فيه تسيمون ينبت لكم به الزرع والزيتون والنخيل والأعناب ومن كل الثمرات إن في ذلك لآية لقوم يتفكرون وسخر لكم الليل والنهار والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره إن في ذلك لآيات لقوم يعقلون وما ذرأ لكم في الأرض مختلفا ألوانه إن في ذلك لآية لقوم يذكرون وهو الذي سخر البحر لتأكلوا منه لحما طريا وتستخرجوا منه حلية تلبسونها وترى الفلك مواخر فيه ولتبتغوا من فضله ولعلكم تشكرون وألقى في الأرض رواسي أن تميد بكم وأنهارا وسبلا لعلكم تهتدون وعلامات وبالنجم هم يهتدون أفمن يخلق كمن لا يخلق أفلا تذكرون وإن تعدوا نعمة الله لا تحصوها إن الله لغفور رحيم والله يعلم ما تسرون وما تعلنون والذين يدعون من دون الله لا يخلقون شيئا وهم يخلقون أموات غير أحياء وما يشعرون أيان يبعثون
الله أكبر
سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين إلهكم إله واحد فالذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة قلوبهم منكرة وهم مستكبرون لا جرم أن الله يعلم ما يسرون وما يعلنون إنه لا يحب المستكبرين وإذا قيل لهم ماذا أنزل ربكم قالوا أساطير الأولين ليحملوا أوزارهم كاملة يوم القيامة ومن أوزار الذين يضلونهم بغير علم ألا ساء ما يزرون قد مكر الذين من قبلهم فأتى الله بنيانهم من القواعد فخر عليهم السقف من فوقهم وأتاهم العذاب من حيث لا يشعرون ثم يوم القيامة يغزوهم ويقول أين شركائي الذين كنتم تشاقون فيهم قال الذين أوتوا العلم إن الخزي اليوم والسوء على الكافرين الذين تتوفاهم الملائكة ظالمي أنفسهم فألقوا السلم ما كنا نعمل من سوء بلى إن الله عليم بما كنتم تعملون فادخلوا أبواب جهنم خالدين فيها فلبئس مثوى المتكبرين وقيل للذين اتقوا ماذا أنزل ربكم قالوا خيرا للذين أحسنوا في هذه الدنيا حسنة ولدار الآخرة خير ولنعم دار المتقين جنات عدن يدخلونها تجري من تحتها الأنهار لهم فيها ما يشاءون كذلك يجزي الله المتقين الذين تتوفاهم الملائكة طيبين يقولون سلام عليكم يقولون سلام عليكم ادخلوا الجنة بما كنتم تعملون هل ينظرون إلا أن تأتيهم الملائكة أو يأتي أمر ربك كذلك فعل الذين من قبلهم وما ظلمهم الله ولكن كانوا أنفسهم يظلمون فأصابهم سيئات ما عملوا وحاق بهم ما كانوا به يستهزئون
الله أكبر
سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر السلام عليكم ورحمة الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين وقال الذين أشركوا لو شاء الله ما عبدنا من دونه من شيء نحن ولا آباؤنا ولا حرمنا من دونه من شيء كذلك فعل الذين من قبلهم فهل على الرسل إلا البلاغ المبين ولقد بعثنا في كل أمة رسولا أن اعبدوا الله واجتنبوا الطاغوت فمنهم من هدى الله ومنهم من حقت عليه الضلالة فسيروا في الأرض فانظروا كيف كان عاقبة المكذبين إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد إيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون ليبين لهم الذي يختلفون فيه وليعلم الذين كفروا أنهم كانوا كاذبين إنما قولنا لشيء إذا أردناه أن نقول له كن فيكون
الله أكبر
سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين والذين هاجروا في الله من بعد ما ظلموا لنبوئنهم في الدنيا حسنة ولأجر الآخرة أكبر لو كانوا يعلمون الذين صبروا على ربهم يتوكلون وما أرسلنا من قبلك إلا رجالا نوحي إليهم فاسألوا أهل الذكر إن كنتم لا تعلمون بالبينات والزبر وأنزلنا إليك الذكر لتبين للناس ما نزل إليهم ولعلهم يتفكرون أفأمن الذين مكروا السيئات أن يقصف الله بهم الأرض أو يأتيهم العذاب من حيث لا يشعرون أو يأخذهم في تقلبهم فما هم بمعجزين أو يأخذهم على تخوف فإن ربكم لرؤوف رحيم أولم يروا إلى ما خلق الله من شيء يتفيأ ظلاله على اليمين والشمائل سجدا لله وهم داخرون ولله يسجد ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من دابة والملائكة وهم لا يستكبرون يخافون ربهم من فوقهم ويفعلون ما يؤمرون الله أكبر الله أكبر وقال الله لا تتخذوا إلهين اثنين إنما هو إله واحد فإياي فارهبون الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر السلام عليكم ورحمة الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين وقال الله لا تتخذوا إلهين اثنين إنما هو إله واحد فإياي فارهبون وله ما في السماوات والأرض وله الدين واصبا فغير الله تتقون وما بكم من نعمة فمن الله ثم إذا مسكم الضر فإليه تجأرون ثم إذا كشف الضر عنكم إذا فريق منكم بربهم يشركون ليكفروا بما آتيناهم فتمتعوا فسوف تعلمون ويجعلون لما لا يعلمون نصيبا مما رزقناهم تالله لتسألن عما كنتم تفترون ويجعلون لله البنات سبحانه ولهم ما يشتهون وإذا بشر أهدهم بالأنثى ظل وجهه مسودا وهو كظيم يتوارى من القوم من سوء ما بشر به أيمسكه على هون أم يدسه في التراب ألا ساء ما يحكمون للذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة مثل السوء ولله المثل الأعلى وهو العزيز الحكيم ولو يؤاخذ الله الناس بظلمهم ما ترك عليها من دابة ولكن يؤخرهم إلى أجل مسمى فإذا جاء أجلهم لا يستأخرون ساعة ولا يستقدمون ويجعلون لله ما يكرهون وتصف ألسنتهم الكذب أن لهم الحسنى لا جرم أن لهم النار وأنهم مفرطون تالله لقد أرسلنا إلى أمم من قبلك فزين لهم الشيطان وأعمالهم فهو وليهم اليوم ولهم عذاب أليم وما أنزلنا عليك الكتاب إلا لتبين لهم الذي اختلفوا فيه وهدى ورحمة لقوم يؤمنون والله أنزل من السماء ماء فأحيا به الأرض بعد موتها إن في ذلك لآية لقوم يسمعون
الله أكبر
سمع الله لمن حمده
الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين وإن لكم في الأنعام لعبرة نسقيكم مما في بطونه من بين فرث ودم لبنا خالصا سائغا للشاربين ومن ثمرات النخيل والأعناب تتخذون منه سكرا ورزقا حسنا إن في ذلك لآية لقوم يعقلون وأوحى ربك إلى النحل أن اتخذي من الجبال بيوتا ومن الشجر ومما يعرشون ثم كلي من كل الثمرات فاسلكي سبل ربك ذللا يخرج من بطونها شراب مختلف ألوانه فيه شفاء للناس إن في ذلك لآية لقوم يتفكرون والله خلقكم ثم يتوفاكم ومنكم من يرد إلى أرذل العمر لكي لا يعلم بعد علم شيئا إن الله عليم قدير والله فضل بعضكم على بعض في الرزق فما الذين فضلوا برادي رزقهم على ما ملكت أيمانهم فهم فيه سواء أفبنعمة الله يجهدون والله جعل لكم من أنفسكم أزواجا وجعل لكم من أزواجكم بنين وحفدة ورزقكم من الطيبات أفبالباطل يؤمنون وبنعمة الله هم يكفرون ويعبدون من دون الله ما لا يملك لهم رزقا من السماوات والأرض شيئا ولا يستطيعون فلا تضربوا لله الأمثال إن الله يعلم وأنتم لا تعلمون ضرب الله مثلا عبدا مملوكا لا يقدر على شيء ومن رزقناه منا رزقا حسنا فهو ينفق منه سرا وجهرا هل يستوون الحمد لله بل أكثرهم لا يعلمون وضرب الله مثل الرجلين أحدهما أبكم لا يقدر على شيء وهو كل على مولاه أينما يوجهه لا يأتي بخير هل يستوي هو ومن يأمر بالعدل وهو على صراط مستقيم
الله أكبر
سمع الله لمن حمده
الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ولله غيب السماوات والأرض، وما أمر الساعة إلا كلمح البصر وهو أقرب، إن الله على كل شيء قدير. والله أخرجكم من بطون أمهاتكم لا تعلمون شيئا، وجعل لكم السمع والأبصار والأفئدة لعلكم تشكرون. ألم يروا إلى الطير مسخرات في جو السماء ما يمسكهن إلا الله، إن في ذلك لآيات لقوم يؤمنون. والله جعل لكم من بيوتكم سكنا، وجعل لكم من جلود الأنعام بيوتا تستخفونها يوم ظعنكم ويوم إقامتكم، ومن أصوافها وأوبارها وأشعارها أثاثا ومتاعا إلى حين. والله جعل لكم مما خلق ظلالا، وجعل لكم من الجبال أكنانا، وجعل لكم سرابيل تقيكم الحر وسرابيل تقيكم بأسكم، كذلك يتم نعمته عليكم لعلكم تسلمون. فإن تولوا فإنما عليك البلاغ المبين. يعرفون نعمة الله ثم ينكرونها وأكثرهم الكافرون.
الله أكبر.
سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. ويوم نبعث من كل أمة شهيدا، ثم لا يؤذن للذين كفروا ولا هم يستعتبون. وإذا رأى الذين ظلموا العذاب فلا يخفف عنهم ولا هم ينظرون. وإذا رأى الذين أشركوا شركاءهم قالوا ربنا هؤلاء شركاؤنا الذين كنا ندعو من دونك، فألقوا إليهم القول إنكم لكاذبون. وألقوا إلى الله يومئذ السلم، وضل عنهم ما كانوا يفترون. الذين كفروا وصدوا عن سبيل الله زدناهم عذابا فوق العذاب بما كانوا يفسدون. ويوم نبعث في كل أمة شهيدا عليهم من أنفسهم، وجئنا بك شهيدا على هؤلاء، ونزلنا عليك الكتاب تبيانا لكل شيء وهدى ورحمة وبشرى للمسلمين.
الله أكبر.
سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر.
الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
لڑکیوں کا مدرسہ گرلز دارالعلوم and there is no one come to here to collect the chanda. Only few people from here, they send the money from here. So request that you can donate the Dilla Zakar in Sarta.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل وسلم على السلام تعالى ربنا وتعاليك يا الجلال والاكرام اللهم اعنا على ذكرك وشكرك وعبادتك اللهم ربنا آتنا في الدنيا حسنه وفي الاخره حسنه واقنا عذاب النار ربنا لا تؤاخذنا ان نسينا او اخطانا ربنا ولا تحمل علينا اسرا كما حملته على الذين من قبلنا ربنا ولا تحملنا ما لا طاقه لنا به واعف عنا واغفر لنا وارحمنا انت مولانا فانصرنا على القوم الكافرين اللهم ربنا ظلمنا أنفسنا وإن لم تغفر لنا وترحمنا لنكونن من الخاسرين رب اغفر لنا رب اغفر لنا رب اغفر لي رب اغفر لي ولوالدي وللمؤمنين يوم يقوم الحساب اللهم رب ارحمهما كما ربياني صغيرا اللهم رب ارحمهما كما ربياني صغيرا اللهم إنا نسألك من خير ما سألك منه نبيك وحبيبك محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم ونعوذ بك من كل شر ما استعاذك منه نبيك وحبيبك محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم وأنت المستعان وعليك البلاغ ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم سبحان ربك رب العزة عما يصفون وسلام على المرسلين والحمد لله
صلاة الوتر الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين لإيلاف قريش إيلافهم رحلة الشتاء والصيف فليعبدوا رب هذا البيت الذي أطعمهم من جوع وآمنهم من خوف الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين قل هو الله أحد الله الصمد لم يلد ولم يولد ولم يكن له كفوا أحد الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
الله أكبر. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. قل أعوذ برب الفلق، من شر ما خلق، ومن شر غاسق إذا وقب، ومن شر النفاثات في العقد، ومن شر حاسد إذا حسد. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. سمع الله لمن حمده. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. الله أكبر. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Inshallah, today's dars will be conducted by the eloquent Maulana Adil Taghari Sahib. So all brothers are requested to participate. Jazakallah.
This one to be the best thing.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله وكفى وسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي سبحانك لا علم لنا إلا ما علمتنا إنك أنت العليم الحكيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear respected brothers, elders and fellow community members So last week we set the stage and we did all of the groundwork and paved the way for the next few sessions. Can anybody remember the watchword and the motto from last lesson? Ramadan is a month of resistance, not a month of rest. So last week, we deconstructed the conventional wisdom surrounding Ramadan. Ramadan is a time of passivity. Ramadan is a time of sleep deprivation. Ramadan is a time for us to unwind and decompress. And we smashed that with a sledgehammer. And we replaced that, if you can remember, we gave the analogy of microchips. So Ramadan isn't an event that exists within time. Ramadan is actually a critique of how we perceive time. Time isn't just a currency for enrichment or for empowerment or for bodily comfort or that drive for convenience. Time is actually a pathway to the hereafter. And that's our currency to be able to do as many good deeds as possible. But time for us has been overtaken, hijacked, commandeered even by this consumerist capitalist idea of time is money. You hear it in the workplace and it's become a corporate slogan now. But Allah tells us time is not money. Time is the currency of your life, which is then going to be deposited in a bank account. And then you can tap into that savings account in the hereafter. And that whole idea of you have to store something away and then you can only access it later on is intended to deconstruct again the idea of instant gratification. You have to achieve everything and anything in this very moment. Ramadan completely dismantles that entire construct. And Ramadan teaches you, you want food, your body needs food actually to sustain itself, well, you have to wait. Why do you have to wait? Simply because Allah told you. And then we also looked at the metaphysical significance and the consequence of starving your body. If you starve your body, then what you're actually doing is you're proportionately feeding and sustaining your soul. And your soul is connected to Allah. And your soul will then be able to dictate how much help from Allah is acquired and how much you alienate Allah's help. And then we said, this is the greatest paradox because the month of Ramadan is actually associated historically with victory and triumph and resistance. And we gave a few examples, the Battle of Badr in the month of Ramadan. Then we had a look at the liberation of Mecca that happened in the month of Ramadan as well. And then we gave two examples last week, two different sides of the same coin. One event from history which epitomized the spirit of resilience and resistance and discipline in Ramadan. And then another event which is the antithesis, the complete opposite of what Ramadan should actually represent. Can anybody remember the first event? Tariq ibn Ziyad in the year 711. And he achieved victory at the Battle of Wadi Lakka against King Roderick of the Visigoths, vastly outnumbered. But he instilled discipline into his troops. If you can remember, he burnt all of the ferries. And he told his troops, you have the enemy in front of you and you have the Strait of Gibraltar behind you. Where will you run off to? So there was a little bit of daring, courage and risk-taking involved there. And then the opposite event, which yielded negative adverse results, was the Battle of Tours, or the Pavement Martyrs, in the year 732. Again, these troops had moved out from Andalusia. It was in the month of Ramadan. What held them back? It was very similar. The outcome was very similar to the Battle of Uhud. So they were enamored by materialism. Just like the archers who'd been posted on the hillock at the Battle of Uhud, and they were given strict orders not to move, remain there as firm as a rock, no matter what you see unfolding on the battlefield beneath you. They had heard, rumor had spread, that the Muslims had gained the upper hand. They abandoned their posts. That allowed Khalid ibn Walid to outflank the Muslims, and they were caught in a pincer movement. The exact same thing happened with Abdurrahman al-Ghafiqi against Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours. The troops were on the front line. They were like a huge glacier of ice, immovable and indomitable. But then a rumor again had circulated that the spoils of war that they'd accumulated over the past 3 or 4 weeks of pillaging and plundering and ransacking Christian towns in southern France, that was all at risk now. It was all exposed. So half of the troops abandoned their position, they deserted their commander Abdurrahman, and they went to secure the spoils, and now the entire battle formation was in disarray, and forget about there being a chink in the armor, there was an entire breach that Charles now had exploited. But if you can remember, when the Muslims were marching from one place to another with this inexorable advance in the south of France, then some of Charles's spies said, we need to move fast, otherwise we'll be completely decimated. But Charles said, listen to my strategy very carefully and follow what I have to say to a T. Don't interrupt the enemy. Let them encumber themselves with spoils. Let them load as much war booty and as much treasure on their backs as possible, and that will weigh them down. And when they are suppressed by this anvil of materialism of the world, then that's when we strike. And that was ultimately their downfall. So now we move on to our next decisive moment. And I guess this is very pertinent because we are going to be looking at, over the next half an hour or so, Salah ad-Din. Is there anybody here who hasn't heard of Salah ad-Din before? I would be surprised if you'd find any Muslim who's never heard of Salah ad-Din before. They might not be able to give you details, they might not be able to give you some granular points of data, but I guarantee you every single Muslim will have heard of Salah ad-Din. Now, when Salah ad-Din's memory is invoked, then usually people will automatically associate Salah ad-Din with the conquest and recapture of Jerusalem. Now, that took place in 1187 in the month of October. And most people will have this within their popular imagination. Salah ad-Din with his troops flanking him on either side will be swashbuckling like a pirate parrying crusader blow after blow. He's striking down knights and Templars and Hospitaller knights, and he is this one-man army. He is a lone ranger, and it might be this very stylized and very Hollywood-esque blockbuster image of Salah ad-Din then marching into Jerusalem triumphantly, and then the credits start rolling. But history is less romantic than we would like to imagine it. History is a lot more sober. So when you open up the books of history and you have a look at the real Salah ad-Din, then you'll realize something. And this is going to be today's key takeaway message. Salah ad-Din was not born in a vacuum. Salah ad-Din was not simply an individual. Salah ad-Din was not a lone ranger. Salah ad-Din was a product, a cumulative product, of a process that had been gradually building pace for 2 centuries. For 2 centuries. Let me just reiterate that. That one final battle, we're going to have a look at the Battle of Hittin today, which pretty much paved the way for Jerusalem to be taken. It flung the doors of Jerusalem wide open. The Battle of Hittin took place in July 1187, and then 3 or 4 months later, Salah ad-Din's men had reclaimed the streets of Jerusalem. But that last moment, 2nd of October, 1187, that was just the crescendo. That was simply the peak. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And I think this actually tells us a lot more about our own psyche and the way we back project our own expectations on history. And again, what does it go back to? Instant gratification. So people will overlook the 30 years worth of grafting and elbow grease Salah ad-Din had to invest into this project before he could reach that final moment. That was the pinnacle of his career. And then if we zoom out a little bit more, then we'll actually appreciate Salah ad-Din was a fantastic general, but Salah ad-Din wasn't a Khalid ibn al-Walid. As a warrior on the battlefield, and people might take offense at this, Salah ad-Din was mediocre at best. Even as a strategist, or maybe even a tactician, Salahuddin was average. Right? If you were to compare his track record with Khalid ibn Walid, chalk and cheese. But then why is Salahuddin so memorialized and so immortalized? Because he didn't look in the past and think to himself, Khalid ibn Walid and Abu Ubaidah ibn Jarrah and Umar radiallahu anhu, Amr ibn al-As, all of these legendary companions, they were the ones who'd taken Jerusalem for the first time in the year 636, 637. So I need to be a carbon copy of them. I need to then inculcate all of the traits that they had. That's the only way I can secure victory. If I can just copy and paste a past template onto today. That's not how Salahuddin worked. Salahuddin's forte lies in two things. Number one, this is a personal trait. Salahuddin was very patient. Salahuddin was level-headed. Salahuddin was not a reactionary. And this is how most Muslims are today, actually. Most Muslims today are reactionaries. Everything we do is a flash in the pan. We see something on the news, it makes splash headlines, so we'll put a few things on our status, and then by the time we go to sleep, we've forgotten that some poor garden child halfway across the world has been vaporized by an Israeli thermal bomb. We just carry on, blissfully ignorant. So there is no consistency, and there is no structure. But Salahuddin plied his trade for nearly 30 years, and he was very, very deliberate and very, very meticulous in what he did. And he never, ever, ever took a step until he appreciated all of the consequences. Let me just highlight one incident. Salahuddin had many confidants. One of them was called Ibn Shaddad, and he's actually written a biography. He was a contemporary, he wrote a biography of Salahuddin. Ibn Shaddad said, we were in Jerusalem, and I'm jumping to the end of Salahuddin's career here. This was during the time of the Third Crusade. Richard the Lionheart and Frederick, the Holy Roman Emperor, and a whole pantheon of other European monarchs had actually banded together to defeat Salahuddin because he'd just taken Jerusalem. So this was meant to be the greatest campaign of vengeance that the Europeans had launched. And Salahuddin was perturbed because this was the most frightful, the most petrifying, and the most behemoth-like army the Europeans had ever mobilized, marching to his doorstep. So Salahuddin at night would convene with Ibn Shaddad and a few of his other confidants, and they would hash out strategy amongst themselves. Now Ibn Shaddad writes, everybody else was giving these fantastical harebrained ideas, send out these troops and besiege this city. Salahuddin just absorbed everything. Salahuddin didn't really say much, he just soaked it all in. But you could tell he was carrying the weight of the world with him. He was constantly overtaken by this very pensive, reflective mood, where he was always thinking and calculating. He was always wandering 10 steps ahead. And Salahuddin said, I think we just need to have a bit of a breather. So everybody else went away, and the session was adjourned. And then they came back. This was all throughout the night. And they came back. Salahuddin had just performed his ablution. He'd just read his dawn prayers, his fajr. And Ibn Shaddad said, look, you look pale, you've got glazed eyes. I can tell that this is taking its toll on you. The mental stress is visible and palpable on your face. And Salahuddin said, I'm absolutely fine. Maybe you might want to go to sleep. All of you can have rest, but I'm going to stay here and I need to think about things properly. So Salahuddin epitomized the hadith where the Prophet ﷺ said, Al-anatu min Allah wal-ujla min ash-shaytan. Very simple. Patient deliberation is a divine characteristic, not rushing headfirst into things, being brazen or erratic or rash. That wasn't Salahuddin's way. وَلُعُجِلَ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ. And being hasty, wanting instant gratification, wanting results to materialize and be microwavable in front of you, that's a trait of the devil. And when we have a look at Salahuddin's career, he didn't spring into this world. He didn't burst forth from his mother's womb, and then day one, he grabbed his scimitar and sword, and he just started, you know, hacking and hewing until he reached the doorstep of Jerusalem. So that's point number one. Point number two, Salahuddin was a product. Salahuddin was a product of something which I guarantee you, most of you will not have heard of. Salahuddin was a product of something which is called the Great Sunni Revival. Salahuddin is a product of a renaissance. Salahuddin is a product of a structure. But that structure took 2 centuries to stabilize. There were the architects, there were the constructors, there were the decorators, and then finally there was Salahuddin. So Salahuddin was merely a figure in a cumulative process, which we'll hopefully unpack today. So the first thing to do is to separate the man from the myth. So we've put the mythical Salahuddin on one side. But Salahuddin, it's difficult to filtrate the myth from the fact, because Salahuddin, during his very life, became a legendary figure. So Christians actually claim Salahuddin as one of their own, which is a bizarre fact. Christians claim that he was actually knighted by a crusader. Christian chroniclers claimed he was just too magnanimous and too generous and too charitable and too moral of a human being to have been a Muslim. That was the dilemma for Christians. And they couldn't square this triangle. How can somebody who's such a perfect human being be a Muslim? So all sorts of theories abounded after he died that actually Salahuddin was a closeted Christian, and Salahuddin made a journey to Paris. Don't know how he managed to escape the hundreds of chroniclers around him. No Muslim ever recorded that, but apparently a European said he made his way to Paris and he came to a cathedral and he was baptized in a cathedral. That's why he was such a fantastic human being. So that's a legendary Salahuddin. But the Salahuddin, as a simple man, was a lot more grounded, and the reality was a lot more sober. But Salahuddin was just a block in this entire edifice and structure. So let's take a step back and let's have a look at what was actually happening, because we need to give a little bit of historical context here. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam passed away in 632, and then you had 30 years worth of rightly guided leadership. Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, Umar, Uthman, Ali and Hassan radiallahu anhum, all 5 of them, the rightly guided caliphs as they're called. And they ruled for around 30 years. And then caliphal authority passed on to a new branch and a new family called the Umayyads. The Umayyads ruled for around 100 years, maybe 90 years. The events we looked at last week took place under the Umayyad dynasty, under their auspices. And then in the year 750, there was a very violent and bloody changing of the guard. So the Umayyads were ousted, and then in their place came the Abbasids. I'm sure people have heard of the Abbasids. The so-called Muslim Golden Age happened during the Abbasid period. But the Abbasids were in charge for a long, long time, from 750 all the way till 1258. So for nearly 550 odd years, for nearly 5 centuries. So a lot happened during that period. So this great Sunni revival, as we call it, this happened when the Muslim world was racked by turmoil. And there was chronic unrest and instability, specifically in Iraq. So if we fast forward from 750, we've heard of caliphs like Harun al-Rashid and other legendary figures. This was the early glory day of the Abbasids. Their heyday dissipated, and then eventually, as all things that have once risen, they have to eventually come back down to earth. So deterioration set in to the establishment of the Abbasids. And by the time you get to the mid-900s, 2 new threats have emerged in the Muslim world, which is why historians call the mid-900s to the mid-1000s the Shia century, as it's called, because Shia dynasties on the periphery managed to break through into the center. So from the east, you had a Shia dynasty of freebooters and marauders called the Buyids, who came from northern Iran. And they had actually swept across the Muslim heartlands, made it all the way to the Abbasid caliph's palace, and taken him hostage. So just imagine that. The Abbasid caliph, the figurehead of the Muslim world, is now at the mercy of not just any old palace hijackers, but Shia, which would have rubbed that theological dust and dirt into the caliph's nose. And this was the supreme representative of the Muslim world. And then on the opposite flank of the Muslim world, there was a new dynasty on the ascendancy called the Fatimids. And the Fatimids had made their way from North Africa, Tunisia, all the way to Egypt, and they had declared their own counter-caliphate. And again, they were Shia, a very radical, extremist form of Shia. So now you have Baghdad in the middle, caught like a sandwich in between 2 Shia dynasties. And this was probably the nadir and the lowest point for the Abbasid Caliphate. Because in Baghdad, you had Shia celebrations, like celebrating the 10th of Muharram, or celebrating, as they call it, Eid Ghadir, which is when Ali radiallahu anhu was supposedly anointed by the Prophet to be his successor. All of these things were now being celebrated right there in front of the Sunni Caliph, in front of all the Sunni scholars, in front of a majority Sunni populace. So it was very insulting and religiously offensive, because the whole project was meant to be a Sunni caliphate. And then the Shia started to become quite bold in their claims of religious supremacy. And then on the streets of Baghdad, you had street brawls and argy-bargies and bust-ups and fights. And then even Baghdad started to get cordoned off into a Shia quarter and then a Sunni quarter. So things were really bad. And throughout this entire period, the Abbasid Caliph was at the mercy of these Shia strongmen and sultans or enforcers, as they're called. And one caliph even went as far as to say, this was his admission of impotency and powerlessness, he said to his Shia hostage taker, he said, look, the only reason I'm here is because you need me to give you legitimacy. Otherwise, if you just had a Shia at the top, then your entire edifice would crumble. Nobody would follow you. So you need me just to be the puppet and the figurehead. He said, I mean, I'm so useless at that job anyway, you might as well just take that away from me as well. So you don't even need to read my name from the pulpits on Friday to give yourselves an air of credibility. You can just do away with it and nobody would be any wiser. So this was a very, very troublesome time for the Muslims. The Shia century, as it's called. And then the first seeds started to be planted of this new structure. And the key takeaway here, I'll just give it to you now so that we can revisit it later on. The key takeaway here is that Muslims today don't suffer from a motivation problem. They don't suffer from a crisis of faith per se. We suffer from a structures problem. We suffer from a systems problem. And I'll explain that at the end with a little bit of extra detail to help that sink in. So mid-900s, early 1000s, things are looking quite bleak for the Muslims. But then the tide starts to change, because the predecessors of the Ottomans arrive on the scene. And they're the Seljuks. The Seljuks came from Central Asia. Now this is so far away from the center. This is on the fringes. And there is a recurring theme in Muslim history, which is whenever inertia and rot starts to set in to the establishment at the core, then revivification or resuscitation of this Muslim project usually comes from the periphery. It doesn't come from the center, because the center has already been compromised. And we talked about this last week as well. Allah says in the Quran, and this is a very important passage, Allah says, if Allah wanted to, in yasha yudhibukum, if Allah wanted to, He could expel you. As a generation, He could say, you know what, you're not good for the job. You just don't make the cut. And you just don't have what it takes to be able to provide for this faith and serve and contribute towards this civilizational project. وَيَأْتِينَ بِآخَرِينَ. And Allah will say, step aside and make way for somebody else. Allah will replace you. Now that replacement doesn't mean He'll cull an entire generation. That replacement means you won't come to the mosque. That replacement means you won't have a role to play in your community. That replacement means you won't see yourself in this larger, grander project. And people will overtake you in providing for the community and establishing institutions and setting up foundations. You'll just fall into obscurity and into the shadows. Which is why it's important every once in a while to stop and take stock of, what am I giving back to the community? It's not good enough to just take. What am I giving back to the community? So, Allah replaced the rot that was happening in the middle, and He enlisted the help of these peripheral foreign aliens. They weren't even Muslims until a few decades before. The Seljuks and their entire tribe, these were Turkic people, accepted Islam, and now they, like a huge tidal wave, swept across the entire Muslim world, from Central Asia, down through Iran, across Iraq, and around the year 1055, 1058, they had managed to liberate the Abbasid Caliph. They defeated the Buyid dynasty, and now the Seljuks were the new powers in town. They were the new kid on the block. Thankfully for the Abbasid Caliph, the Seljuks were also Sunnis. Now, During the early 1000s, the Abbasid Caliph, who was still sequestered and at the mercy of the Buyids, realized, militarily, I can't do anything. And politically, I'm limited in what I can do. So the next best thing for me will be to court the support of the scholarly class. And for me to try and articulate some form of Sunni creed. So Sunniism is just mainstream Orthodox Islam. And it's always existed. It's always been there. It's derived from the Quran and Sunnah. But it hadn't properly been codified or systematized or institutionalized up until that point. And again, another important point is, crisis begets innovation. So maybe if this huge crisis for the Muslim world never happened, then the fruits of that crisis, the silver lining of the crisis, may never have then manifested. So there's always some positive to take back from any sort of negative. So the Abbasid Caliph decided, I am going to now have regular sessions in the Abbasid Caliph's palace, and I'm going to call all of the scholars and civil servants, and I'm going to make them follow a practical step-by-step catechism, as it's called. Catechism means it's a book or a document or a manifesto, and it has different points, very simple, brief points. And these brief points outline Sunni Islam. So what you should believe in, what you shouldn't believe in, how you should practice, and orthodoxy and orthopraxy, as it's called. So he started to deliver these sessions. And it gave a little bit of purpose back to the Muslims. And it invested a little bit of self-confidence into the Muslims. So they managed to salvage a little bit of their dignity and worth, because now we can rally behind a project. We can rally behind a new structure that seeks to restore our glory, not through politics, not through military intervention, not through economics, but through this civilizational project of faith, of religion. And obviously all of this was happening in the foil of Shia Islam. So to combat the influence of Shia Islam, we need to then fortify and shore up our own Sunni structure. This was the beginning of the great Sunni revival, as it's called. And it's now a well-attested to phenomenon, even according to non-Muslim historians. So the Seljuks came onto the scene. And the Seljuks were driven by one man. This one man's name was Nizam al-Mulk. Nizam al-Mulk was a Persian. And Nizam al-Mulk was the vizier, or you could say the prime minister, of the Seljuk Empire. Now Nizam al-Mulk realized, we can't effectively combat militarily the Fatimid Caliphate, who was still active in Egypt, until we have internal stability and internal cohesion. Now we might not think about this now, but it was actually an everyday, mundane, run-of-the-mill occurrence in Baghdad in the 1000s. The four different schools of law were at each other's throats. Right? So we might live in harmony today, but in 11th century Baghdad, there were street brawls between Hanbalis and Shafi'is, and then Malikis and Hanbalis. Usually the Hanbalis were at the center because they were a little bit more militant in their proselytization and the way they pushed the faith forward. But all of this was happening. And Nizam al-Mulk said, we can't have Sunnis bickering amongst themselves when we have greater threats on the horizon. So how did he combat that problem? The problem was combated through the institution of the madrasa. Fascinatingly enough. How does that make any sense? That you have physical violence on the streets of Baghdad that disallow any sort of Muslim community cohesion, so Muslims can then provide an effective front to the enemy. So what do? Turn around and build a madrasa. That seems a bit counterproductive here. That seems a bit counterintuitive. Wouldn't you just assemble and mobilize a huge army and take it to the enemy? Well, yes, you could do, but then where would the discipline come from? Where would the cohesion come from? Where would that united purpose come from? So Nizam al-Mulk said, let's put a halt on everything. Nizam al-Mulk was a fantastic thinker. Salahuddin is actually more like Nizam al-Mulk than anybody else. Nizam al-Mulk was Salahuddin's intellectual predecessor. So Nizam al-Mulk said, I'm going to create a string of institutions. Up until that point, no such thing as a madrasa existed, which is hard to believe. Up until the 1000s, so how did education work? Simple. Come to a mosque, you'd find a scholar at a pillar, you'd sit in that scholar's study circle, and you'd just study with him until he'd say, you're ready to start your own study circle. And then you'd fly away from the nest. Very decentralized, very informal. He said two things. First of all, we need to build what's called an ecumenical structure. Ecumenical means there is harmony and unity. We can't have Hanafis and Shafi'is and Hanbalis bickering amongst each other. Everybody needs to appreciate that we are all part of this same ship. And we can't tear planks off of the ship to beat each other with, otherwise the ship will capsize. That was his philosophy. So he said, I'm going to create a string of institutions called Nizamiya colleges. And actually these Nizamiya colleges ended up providing the blueprints for universities that would later emerge in Europe, specifically in Italy and in England, Oxford University. You can trace its lineage back to these Nizamiya colleges, the first of their kind. So he started, and they were built all across the Muslim world, in Iran, in Iraq, and then they started to spread to Syria. This was his project. The greatest and the grandest of them all was in Baghdad. But then, this is also his point. So he wanted to foster unity, which actually worked like a treat, because now you have scholars, now you have people who are coming to a specific institution, learning a specific right in Islamic law, and then appreciating the differences that exist between, and learning to live with them. But this was the most important part. Number two, what he appreciated was, we can't execute a revival of Muslim fortunes until we have our vanguard. You need to have your phalanx, as the Romans used to have. Huge, massive army. The army was redundant if the phalanx, the troops at the start, didn't do their job properly, because they were to be thrust into the crucible head first. So that's why Nizam al-Mulk said, we're going to have these madrasas to institutionalize education, to foster unity, but more importantly, we are going to churn out classes of scholars who will be active within the community. But more importantly, we're going to take scholars who are before part-time scholars. You'd maybe go to the mosque, you'd find Imam Abu Hanifa, who'd be teaching in a study circle, and then you'd go outside, and then you'd find Imam Abu Hanifa, who'd be running his stall. It wasn't a stall, he had a huge, you know, multinational company, if you want to call it that. He was a very successful businessman. But they'd be part-time scholars. Nizam al-Mulk said, we can't have that happening. We need scholars to be professionals, and we need scholars to be part of the government process. So then, these Nizamiya colleges would take in students, would provide all the tuition support and funding, and then at the end of the conveyor belt, you'd have a scholar who'd be ready-made for the bureaucracy of the Abbasids, who'd work for the Seljuks. So now you have a scholarly vision being integrated into the political sphere. And Nizam al-Mulk's project, during his lifetime, reached this crescendo with a specific man called Imam al-Ghazali. Everybody's heard of Imam al-Ghazali? Imam al-Ghazali was appointed as the chief professor of the Nizamiya College in Baghdad. That's like being the dean of Oxford or the dean of Cambridge. There is no more of a prestigious role that you could achieve in academia anywhere in the world. Imam al-Ghazali had that. But Imam al-Ghazali was specifically chosen for that. Imam al-Ghazali was specifically chosen for that. Nizam al-Mulk had hand-selected Imam al-Ghazali. Why? Because Imam al-Ghazali represented a confluence or a convergence of three different ideas: Islamic law, Islamic spirituality, and then a pushback against radical ideas, Shia Islam, and then philosophy. Imam al-Ghazali was spiritually attuned. Imam al-Ghazali wasn't just an academic whose brain was filled with data. He was somebody who had a reified and a polished heart. And he actually brought about the science of Sufism and spirituality and esotericism, as it's called, focusing on your soul and cultivating a relationship with Allah. He merged that with raw academia. Because when he was studying in Baghdad, he actually had to take a break. Imam al-Ghazali, as the dean, suffered an identity crisis. He said, I'm here as his head professor, I have thousands of students, I have fame, I have prestige, I have the backing of the state, and I still feel empty. Why is that? So he dropped everything, he abdicated from his position, and he just wandered around for around 10 years. He took a sabbatical, and he sojourned. And during those 10 years, he contemplated. He never taught, he never preached, he never lectured. He just focused on cultivating inner stillness and quietude. And then he wrote his own autobiography, and he said, now I found out the problem. I was trying to find God through books and research and data. Now I've found God through experience. I have to put myself out there and taste the sweetness of faith through worship. And then he came back to his teaching position stronger than ever. But he inculcated that vision of spirituality within the Nizamiya process. So Nizam al-Mulk planted the seed. Imam al-Ghazali then breathed the life of spirituality into the establishment. And then what was meant to be taken forward was put to a grinding halt. There was a rupture. Nizam al-Mulk was assassinated by Shia Ismaili assassins. If anybody's ever played Assassin's Creed, right, it's a game. The original one used to be on PlayStation 3. That game is based off of these assassins, right, Ismaili Shia assassins. He was executed and assassinated. And then the Seljuk Sultan, Malik Shah, was also assassinated. This was late 1000s, 1092. And then 3 years later, 1095, the Council of Clermont in France, Pope Urban II declares the Crusades. So the project has to be put on halt now because Pope Urban II uses language that mirrors the war on terror today. The Muslims are persecuting the Christians in Jerusalem. It was an absolute load of nonsense. So we need to mobilize all of the European empires and states and monarchies and march to the land of milk and honey. And the first people to jump up were opportunists and were people who had zero socioeconomic prospects, people who are at the bottom. You could scrape the barrel of European society, and those people were the people who engaged in the People's Crusade in 1096 and then the First Crusade in 1097. And that's it. The Muslim world was taken by storm. The Muslim world was taken by storm. The project had to be put on hold. Now, for 30 or 40 years, right, 1099, Jerusalem's taken. I'm going to have to skip a few parts here. 1099, Jerusalem's taken. And the scenes of that first bloody, sanguine conquest of Jerusalem at the hands of the Crusaders are grotesque. Grotesque and gruesome. And even some monks, German monks, who accompanied the Crusaders were even too ashamed to record them in their chronicles. Almost 60 to 70,000 people were killed in Jerusalem itself. These are non-combatants. And the horses of Crusaders, not people, the horses of Crusaders were wading knee-deep in rivers of blood flowing through the old city, the streets of Jerusalem. One chronicler said, I saw Crusader troops grabbing small children by the ankles and whirling them over battlements. I saw women and children being hacked and hewed, and their body parts were just strewn across the streets. He said Jews had taken refuge in a synagogue, and the synagogue was burnt to a cinder with all of them still inside. And then they reached Temple Mount, or Al-Aqsa compound, and then the Templar Knights, who were the most fanatical out of all of the Crusaders, hoisted a golden cross on top of the Dome of the Rock, and they renamed it to Templum Domini, or the Temple of Domination. And the Muslim world was stupefied. The Abbasid Caliph did absolutely nothing. The Seljuks, whom Nizam al-Mulk had tried to keep so united and so compact and compressed as a unit, had disintegrated. It hadn't even been 10 years since Nizam al-Mulk's death, and now the Seljuk vast empire had now been fragmented into small little petty fiefdoms. So these were cities, an entire empire reduced in our cities. One ruler here, one ruler there, and they were at each other's throats. So there was no unified response. And what about the Fatimid Ismaili Shia? They were actually in charge of Palestine. They had entered into a pact. They had entered into a treacherous pact of collusion with the Crusaders, the Shia Fatimids in Egypt. They said to the advancing Crusaders, hush, hush, wink, wink, why don't you take half of Syria, push out the Seljuks, we don't like the Seljuk Sunnis, we'd rather side with the Crusaders than have other fellow Muslims, albeit from a different denomination, in charge of Syria. But the Fatimids had made a massive fatal overreach because they assumed the Crusaders were here just for a quick adventure, a bit of an excursion, and then they'd be back. The Crusaders were there to stay for 90 years. And then that's it. Palestine was lost. And it was actually garrisoned by Fatimid troops. But the Fatimid troops sort of gave the Crusaders an easy go. Nothing happened. For those 40 years, right, from 1099 up until maybe the 1144, for nearly 45 years, not a single Muslim, maybe a few anomalous figures, in the Muslim political world, more like warlords, pushed back against the Crusades. That's it. There was no unified front. But do you know who did actually make a clamour, an uproar about it? The scholars who were trained in the Nizamiya schools. For those 30 or 40 years, they were the only voices of reason. The scholars. They were the only ones with moral clarity, and they were calling out at the top of their voices for Muslim unity. Now, there is one scholar, the chief judge of Damascus, Qadi Sa'd al-Din al-Harawi, remember his name, because what he did would be classed as blasphemy, right? And he upset so many people and so many sensitivities, but he had to wake people up from their slumber. So around a year or two after the Crusades has happened, still the Abbasid Caliph silent. In Baghdad, not even a communique, not even a symbolic announcement, no grandstanding, didn't even pay lip service, nothing. Why was that? Because he was too busy getting married. He had his bride who was being flown in from somewhere in northern Iran, and he was preoccupied with wedding preparations. So Qadi Sa'd al-Din, with an entire delegation from the Holy Lands, meandered all the way to Iraq, and they'd shaved their heads. If you shave your head in the medieval world, it's a sign of mourning. So they shaved their heads. But it was seen as an unconventional sign of mourning because Islam doesn't allow it. So it was meant to solicit and court a little bit of controversy. They wanted all eyes to be on them. He burst forth into the palace of the caliph, barged past the caliphal guards, and he said, "How dare you all here frolic around like garden flowers when your brothers and sisters in Palestine have no home except for the bellies of vultures, which means they've been killed and their remains have been eaten, or on the saddles of Christian horses, meaning they've been enslaved and captured. How dare you?" And everybody shed tears, and there were crocodile tears. Nothing happened. So he was incensed. So he went out into the public square in Ramadan and he started eating. He started eating in front of everybody. And everybody was mortified and they were all scandalized, and he got jumped and lynched, and they all said, "How dare you eat in the month of Ramadan?" And then he got up battered and bruised, and he looked at the crowd and he said to them, "Now I know. Now I know that breaking a fast is actually more scandalous to you than your brothers and sisters being killed in Palestine. You're more offended that I'm eating here, and by the way, I'm a traveler, so I can eat." He said, "I can't eat. I've traveled, right? So you didn't factor that in, did you? Right? Your religious sensibilities, right, clouded your judgment. You were too reactionary. So you're angered at this, but you don't care about what's happening over there." So scholars were the voices of reason for at least 30 to 40 years, until finally, a ruthless warlord from Iraq called Imad al-Din Zengi managed to unite the two cities of Mosul and Aleppo. These two cities, for the first time, had been united. Their strength had been combined, and Imad al-Din took the fight to the first Crusader principality called Edessa. So when the Crusaders came, they set up four separate states. It's called Outrimmer. Four separate states, only along the coastal line of Syria. When I say Syria, I mean Greater Syria, which is modern-day Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, and then obviously Syria. They set up four states. There was the county of Edessa, Tripoli, county of Tripoli, which is in Lebanon, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, and then the Principality of Antioch. These were the four. Edessa is close to the border with Turkey and Syria. Imad al-Din took the fight to Edessa and completely razed it to the ground. And this was the first setback the Crusaders had ever taken in 50 years. That triggered the Second Crusade in 1145, which was a huge failure. It was a massive debacle. Half of the troops drowned along the way in a river in Turkey, along with a German emperor. But that was the seed. So Imad al-Din had now paved the way for some sort of a military political reversal. And he died. He was actually killed by his own troops in 1146. But he was something of a brute. He wasn't really a refined political leader. But then we come across his son. His son's name was Nur al-Din. His son's name was Nur al-Din. And Nur al-Din, according to one chronicler called Ibn al-Athir, he says, "I've studied history. You have the Prophet, you have the rightly guided caliphs, you have Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, and then you have Nur al-Din. Then you have Nur al-Din Zengi." He said Nur al-Din Zengi was somebody who had imbibed, he had absorbed the ideas of the great Sunni revival. Nur al-Din Zengi realized two things. Number one, the Crusaders can only be ousted if the main cities of Syria are united, Aleppo and Damascus, and combine that with the forces of Mosul, the most strategic city in Iraq, the Crusaders won't stand a chance. Up until that point, Damascus was still in the hands of a local warlord. Then number two, and this is very, very interesting, Nur al-Din, again, you have the Crusader threat on your doorstep, but Nur al-Din had created and set up at least 40 of these Nizamiya madrasas across Syria. 20 he had personally commissioned. So you see how the project continues. The structure is being created. So now, a lot of these scholars who are being churned out of the institutes are now being employed by Nur al-Din as his informants, as his confidants, as his advisors, as his cadre of scholarly bureaucrats. And they're now training the troops, and they're now reading hadith, and they're now writing books on jihad and resistance and on the virtues of Jerusalem. For those 50 years, when nobody batted an eyelid, the scholars were extolling the virtues of Jerusalem. And that was all part of the scholarly background of the era and of the upbringing of Salah al-Din. So Nur al-Din began creating institutions, remember, structure and system. Hopefully I'll wrap up in the next 5 or 10 minutes. 5 minutes. So Nur al-Din took the mantle on from his father, Imad al-Din. He repulsed the Crusaders, and he now decidedly united Aleppo, Mosul, and Damascus. Damascus now fell to Nur al-Din. This was in the mid-1150s. So where does Salah al-Din fit into all of this? Salah al-Din doesn't even feature anywhere yet, because all of this is happening behind the scenes. The entire stage is being set for Salah al-Din, who is this grand finale character. The denouement and the last act happens with Salah al-Din. So, Nur al-Din was a very austere man, by the way. Nur al-Din was a man who did not take a penny from the state. One of his chroniclers, Ibn al-Athir, actually writes that Nur al-Din never used to take more from the state treasury as his own personal salary than what was needed for his wife to buy 2 or 3 loaves of bread from the local shop. So when his wife then said, "We don't have enough food at home," he said, "I don't own any of this. I don't know what sort of illusions you're beholden to. I don't know what sort of person you think I am. I don't own any of this. I'm just a trustee. This is all within my trust. And I'm simply a custodian and maintainer of the Muslim cause. So if these 2 or 3 loaves of bread aren't enough, then we'll just have to suffice, and we might have to cut our diet down and cut it down to size, but we won't take more than a penny." Salah al-Din was born in the village of Tikrit, which is in Iraq. He was a Kurd, by the way. Salah al-Din was a Kurd, and Nizam al-Mulk was a Persian. Imad al-Din and Nur al-Din were Turks. Right? So here you see the diversity. Here you see how the project had attracted all sorts of different ethnicities and figures from different backgrounds. Salah al-Din was born in a small village in Iraq, and his father, Ayyub, was the most single important determining factor of his career. His father was exactly like him. They were both cut from the same cloth. Very deliberate, very diplomatic, and very level-headed. And he engaged in diplomacy. He actually entered into the service of Imad al-Din. So he'd helped Imad al-Din one day escape from a local rival. Imad al-Din said, "You've been so kind to me, so I'm going to give you the governorship of a small town called Ba'lebek, which is in Lebanon." And Salah al-Din and his father and his uncle, Shirku, diligently served Nur al-Din for a good 10, 15 years. They served the Zengid dynasty. Now, Salah al-Din wasn't actually very particularly gifted in scholarship, and he wasn't exactly a raging lion on the battlefield, but what he did have was magnanimity, chivalry, and that deliberate patience that we talked about at the start. So eventually, when Nur al-Din needed somebody to go to Egypt, I'm cutting the story short here, when somebody was needed to go to Egypt to deal with the Fatimid Caliph, because the Fatimids were now at their weakest point, and the dynasty was about to topple, so the Crusaders thought to themselves, "We can't let Egypt fall to Nur al-Din, we need to have it ourselves." So Salah al-Din was sent with the army. And Salah al-Din eventually became the prime minister to the Fatimid Shia Egyptian Caliph. They had repulsed the Crusaders, and they had purged the Shia cabinet of any radical elements. But then, Salahuddin, there were people clamoring at the back, some scholars, who were saying, you need to defeat the Fatimid Caliph, execute him, and reclaim Egypt for the Sunnis as part of the great Sunni revival. Salahuddin said, not yet. I need to bide my time. I need to test the waters. Egypt's been Shia for nearly 2 centuries. I just can't come in and make these sweeping reforms in one day. So he was the prime minister of a Shia caliph for nearly 2.5 years. But during that time, what did he start to do in Egypt, do you think? You tell me. He started to institute madrasas. He started to plant the seed of the madrasa. So he had a madrasa commissioned in Fustat, which is in Old Cairo. He connected with scholars from Alexandria, which was the Sunni stronghold of Egypt. And he surrounded himself with a cadre of scholars. People like Ibn Shaddad, Qadi al-Fadil, Imaduddin. This is why historians say Salahuddin, just to say Salahuddin is wrong. We talk about the Salahuddin generation. This Salahuddin generation was made up of scholars. These scholars had impressed the importance of Jerusalem on Imaduddin, on Nuruddin, on Salahuddin. They were constantly pointing him in the right direction. They were his moral compasses. So Salahuddin starts to build institutions. And then finally, the Egyptian caliph breathes his last. And then Salahuddin says, no more Fatimids. This land is now reclaimed for the Sunnis. And the Abbasid caliph's name was now pronounced in the Friday sermons. And the Abbasid caliph was so exuberant and he was ecstatic that Egypt has now come back into the fold of the Sunnis. He sent 2 swords to Nur ad-Din. These 2 swords represented the unification of Syria and Egypt. With Syria and Egypt now unified, the Crusaders were terrified. Because now that Muslim unity had been achieved, the only thing that stood in their way was Hittin, or the Battle of Hittin. The Battle of Hittin took place in the year 1187. And in that particular year, Salahuddin had amassed all of his troops. Nur ad-Din had died at least 15 years prior. Salahuddin now took on that mantle. And Salahuddin had amassed the largest army the Muslims had ever seen. And the Crusaders decided to field everything they had. 20,000 Crusaders versus 40,000 Muslim soldiers. And the battle took place at a place called Hittin, which is a small town, just on the outskirts of Lake Galilee, which is in modern-day Palestine. Lake Galilee or Lake Tiberias. And this would prove to be the most decisive battle of the campaign. Now, for those 15 years, Egypt fell in 1171 to Salahuddin. This was in 1187. For those 16 to 17 years, Salahuddin was building his strength and also building institutions, madrasas. Now, Nur ad-Din was so confident that Jerusalem would be recaptured, he had actually commissioned for this artisanal pulpit. I'm sitting on it here, I guess. I guess that's your pulpit. For an artisanal pulpit to be made, like carved out of wood. Expert craftsmen were called in to create a pulpit that Nur ad-Din wanted to place in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So eventually, when Salahuddin did recapture Jerusalem, then that was brought from Damascus and it was placed there. In the year 1187. That lasted all the way up until, I think it was 1996, until a radical Zionist set fire to the pulpit. And it's been reconstructed. So there was always, in this popular imagination, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Salahuddin would sit on horseback mid-battle, and he'd have scholars around him do what? Read hadith. They would read hadith whilst they were out on a campaign. They would sit at the back of the battlefield with their tents, and they would start a hadith recital. Everybody would sit in a circle and they'd read. It happened during Imaduddin's period. And Imaduddin, once upon a time, they came across a hadith called Al-Hadith Musalsal Bit Tabassum, which is, it was a prophetic tradition, and the companions took that upon themselves to smile whenever the hadith is narrated. Because when the Prophet told it to us, he smiled. So when each narrator receives it from his teacher, you smile as well. So everybody started smiling, as was the formality. Nur ad-Din didn't smile. They asked him, it's part of the tradition. He said, how can I crack a smile when Jerusalem is still under occupation? It's impossible. But these ideas were planted into their minds by that cadre of scholars who were the products and the alumni of the Nizamiya colleges. So eventually, 1187, Salahuddin then completely decimates a crusader force. But before the battle, somebody says to Salahuddin, some of his advisors, they asked him, what should we do? We've got a huge force here. Should we split them up into different detachments and contingents? Should we meet the enemy head on? Should we march straight to Jerusalem? Salah ad-Din said, look, first of all, victory is in the hands of Allah. He said, human beings are at the mercy of Allah's plans. We can't do anything. Our lifetime in this world is limited, and we only have a short amount of days and seconds. So we have to capitalize when the time is right, and we bide our time when the moment is perfect. He said, now is the time to strike. So he was deliberate, but he wasn't risk averse. He was patient and he was level-headed, but he knew when a strategic risk had to be taken. During that battle, Stanley Lane Poole, famous historian, British historian, he says that the flower of the Crusader army lay on the battlefield. He said nearly 30,000 had been killed. Nearly 30,000 had been killed on the battlefield, and Salah ad-Din had took the day. He took the day. 4 months later, he was marching into Jerusalem, and there was no day more ecstatic and euphoric to the Muslims than the day they entered into Jerusalem. And that was after 90 years. And if you can recall the bloodshed that the Crusaders had wreaked when they first entered, Salah ad-Din completely reversed that trend, and he said, everybody in the city has amnesty. Everybody can leave. And he said, the old people who have to pay a toll to leave, I'll pay that on your behalf. He gave everybody free passage. Not a single soul was harmed, not even pricked by a thorn when leaving that city. During his lifetime, he achieved that legendary status. Then the Third Crusade happened and the famous incident between Richard the Lionheart and Salah ad-Din. Salah ad-Din died in 1193. When he died, he had 47 silver coins on him and one gold coin in his possession. That translates to around £400. This is somebody who's in charge of an empire from Egypt to Syria to Iraq, £400 on him. And his chronicler says throughout his entire life, never once was zakah an obligation on him. He never once had to pay zakah because he never owned enough property or assets to calculate zakah on. Everything he had in his possession was a trust for the Muslim community. And his chronicler said when he died, he was listening to the words, هُوَ اللَّهُ الَّذِي لَا إِلَٰهَ إِلَّا هُوَ عَالِمُ الْغَيْبِ وَالشَّهَادَةِ. He is Allah, the knower of the seen and the unseen. And Salah ad-Din finally breathed his last. So the takeaway lesson is, Salah ad-Din was simply a product of a process that had been brewing for how many centuries? For 2 centuries. And it took 2 centuries to see results. And that tree finally bore fruits with Salah ad-Din. So if we want to see results, then we need to build institutions. We need systems and we need structures. This was a point that I neglected to mention, but we don't have time to go into it. There's a special report called the State of Muslim Purpose Report. Around 3,500 Muslims were surveyed from 101 countries. And the report and its findings are staggering. Most Muslims don't have a motivation problem. Most Muslims don't need to be told what to do. They already know what to do. Most Muslims already have the passion. But the environment is structurally engineered to be hostile towards Muslim ambitions. It doesn't allow you to then find yourself. It doesn't allow you to practice your faith properly. It doesn't allow you to express yourself in all different institutions. So the report finally concluded with Muslims have a structures issue. We don't have institutions where people can be nurtured. We don't have institutions pumping out people who are engaged in society. We don't have institutions where thoughts and ideas are nurtured, just like this great Sunni revival project. And the report concluded with something fantastic, which is we don't need knowledge. There is more knowledge available today than there was throughout human history. We don't need knowledge. We need to be known. We need to know who we are ourselves first. We need to find a purpose. Salah ad-Din's purpose was Jerusalem, and he never lost sight of that. Every step of the way, it was always Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he allows us to invest within our own systems and our own structures, and he allows us to take a leaf from the life of Salah ad-Din. Ameen.
Amen.